Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. There are many different ways to describe what Peggy Ornstein's new book, Unraveling, is about. It's the story of how to make a sweater from scratch, with all the writerly scenes and well-placed facts. And it's also a meditation on growing older, on what home is or can be, and on the interwoven pleasures and dangers of Northern California life. And it's an argument for the neglected importance of textiles as a driver of global history, cotton, colonialism, industrialization. Through it all, Ornstein follows the golden thread of what it is to be a woman today, what it was long ago, and what it might be for her daughter who's leaving home. We'll talk knitting and life with Peggy Ornstein after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Peggy Ornstein's here in Studio B with us this morning. She's a best-selling author, most recently of Girls and Sex and Boys and Sex. And now, naturally, she's turned her attention to another controversial topic, knitting. Her new book is Unraveling: What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. It's a memoir about that near empty nest feeling and so much more. Welcome, Peggy.
Thanks for having me on, Alexis.
So why don't you set us up in this book a little bit, and then we're going to have you read. Like, what's kind of going on in your life when you decide that you must go shear a sheep?
Yeah, I mean, you made a joke about sex to knitting, and but I feel like this book isn't really a departure for me, because I think my beat has always been about examining the unexamined, and particularly in ordinary life, and particularly in women's lives. And so this, you know, this thing that I decided to do during the pandemic when everybody else was off, you know, making sourdough and doom scrolling, I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll go shear a sheep and process and spin yarn and dye it with natural dyes and make it into a sweater, because I don't have anything else to do. But it was really a vehicle for me to look at a lot of things, like a little omnivore's dilemma. Why don't we look at our clothes the way we look at our food? Mm-hmm. A little bit of history of women's labor and why, and, you know, that needlework has always been a vehicle for dissent for women, and why, you know, making those pussy hats, there was a reason that the first thing we did was knit after Trump was elected, or, you know, weird lore like why the ancient Greeks didn't see blue. And then what was going on with me, which was I was a woman in late middle age in lockdown in a fire zone in Northern California with my child, you know, facing the empty nest, also navigating with my child, who's a person of color, during the pandemic and the racial uprisings, and how, you know, parenting her through that, and a mother who just died, and a father in dementia that I couldn't see. So all of that is woven, yes, woven, throughout this story.
It's funny. I mean, we're going to talk about the language aspects of weaving and textile arts, which are just all throughout our language. So I apologize to everyone in advance for all of the following the thread, weaving these things together, the warp and weft of, you know, there's all of these things.
Right? Like, yeah. We send texts. Texts are have the same root as textile. And there's a reason why we call them threads when we spin out our texts in technology. Even now, even in this advanced, you know, virtual world, we're still doing it with textiles.
That's fascinating. Let's have you read a little bit from this book so people can get a taste. This is from your introduction.
Okay. I wasn't ready. Not for any of it. There are libraries of books on for women on balancing work and motherhood. I wrote one myself, as if that is the entirety of our existence. This next phase? It's like dropping off a cliff. Yet another cliff. We are not a culture, to say the least, that venerates older women. The sheer amount of age-forfending plastic surgery we engage in, not blaming, just noting, is testament to that. When someone wrote in the New York Times that while she was turning 60, she still felt 20, I thought, yes and no. Turning 60? I feel 60. Like, even though I can flex, still do a handstand in yoga class, that doesn't take away from the amount of sand at the bottom of my personal hourglass. Now, suddenly in lockdown, I had a lot of time to ruminate about how I got here, what I might have done differently, how I might spend the precious productive years that remained, how few they were starting to seem in number. Writing felt impossible, but that didn't matter. My work had evaporated anyway, leading to yet another source of panic. Just when I'd gotten my life together, it seemed to be unraveling.
Hmm. That was Peggy Ornstein reading from her new book, Unraveling: What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. Two things. It's not the world's ugliest sweater. It's on the back of the book. It's a perfectly nice sweater. And two, can you really do a headstand still?
I can do a handstand, baby.
Handstand. Whoa.
Headstand's easy peasy.
I've never been able to do that. I'm very impressed.
Yeah. Thank you. But, you know, I want to just kind of say something about The Ugliest Sweater.
Sure.
I know it's not. Part of it was I got very attached to that title. But that was also about process. One of the really big takeaways for me in writing Unraveling was that was learning to re-embrace process and the beginner's mind. And I think that for those of us particularly who do something sort of creative for a living, you know, it gets wrapped up in commerce and marketing and sales and all these other things. And so the creativity and the joy in that erodes a little bit. And through the whole book, I'm sort of going, ugh, I suck at this. Oh, I'm terrible. Oh, I can't do this. You know, oh, blah, blah, blah. And then there's a moment where I kind of go, oh, wait, this is the point. It's learning to love doing again and not being so attached to whether the result is ugly or pretty or fits or doesn't fit.
Yeah, I love that. I want you to talk a little bit about this sort of, you know, the global importance of fiber arts. I mean, there's an amazing example in the book where you're talking about how Viking sails might have been made, right? Because we think of, you know, global history, sometimes we'll think about, oh, these ships that went sailing. But we don't think about, well, where did they get the sails from?
I know. We think about the guys with the little weird hats, right? Somebody had to spin everything, everything that they did. It was years of labor to make one sail, years of woman labor. And women in ancient times, they spent inordinate, I mean, they spent all their time spinning because somebody, there were no machines. You know, they just had to sit there and do it. And one of, you know, I mean, I think as a journalist, you're always asking the five W's, right? Who, what, where, why, and the H, how, which. And so for me, part of this was like looking, going like, yarn, how?
Right.
How did this happen? You know, knitting, who thought of that? You know, like all that kind of, and I didn't know when I wrote this book, I thought, oh, I'm going to go do this kind of goofy thing. I did not realize you could tell the whole history of the world through text, like you can through salt or tea. You know, like the whole history of the world came into this. It was boggling to me and stunning.
Yeah. Let's just line out the steps. I don't want to go quite deep into them yet, but let's line out the steps of if you were to start at, you know, we've got the sweater at the end.
Right.
What are the things you have to do if you were to actually make this, you know, from scratch?
You got to find a sheep.
So raise a sheep. Okay. Step one.
Find a sheep. Yeah. You have to learn how to shear the sheep, that, which is honestly the most physically grueling thing I have ever done in my life. It was so hard. I just really went into it so blithely thinking, yeah, I'm going to shear it. You know, it was so hard. Calorie for calorie or minute for minute, it burns twice as many calories as marathon running. It is insanely difficult.
And that's just because you're like holding the animal with your knees, kind of. You're like, you're wrestling the animal while also.
And I want to be clear, it does not, sheep need to be shorn. It does not hurt them any more than getting a haircut hurts you when it's done correctly and humanely. But they're big and they don't particularly want to be there any more than my dog likes it when I, you know, trim her.
Right.
And they've got hooves and they kick and you're holding a hot, whirring blade with no safety on it. So there's a kind of terror. But it's like a dance. You learn these steps. And the guy who invented it is called the Nureyev of shearing, the Bowen method. And there's 9 positions and you learn how to do them. It's really hard.
Physically demanding.
It's physically demanding, yeah.
Okay, so we've got...
So shearing. Then you have to... You've got a lot of gunky fleece that's full of, you know, poo and barnyard and stuff, and you got to wash that all. You've got to card it, which you might maybe did when you were a kid at some, like, field trip.
I have no... I was trying to even imagine what carding looked like and had to Google it.
Oh, like, really? What,
yeah. So, like, maybe describe.
Also, I'm from Minnesota, so we did that, like, as you know, on a field trip. So, well, it's like two dog, like, if you brush your dog and you know what those dog brushes look like,
yeah.
You take a little bit of the fleece and you kind of puff it up, you lay it on there, and then you have to go back and forth. And it is as difficult as shearing was, it was fascinating, fun. Carding, the most boring
dead
thing.
Dead boring.
Dead yeah. boring. And so you have to do this little bit, and then you have to, doing the one little bit took me 10 minutes, and you have to do 579 of those things called Rolags that I've heard to make a sweater. And so I was like, 10 minutes, I have to do 579 of these. This is going to take.
You're like, that's a lot of minutes
forever.
Of my life.
But what I did, which was really, ended up being amazing, was hanging out with my dad on Zoom. Because it was, or on FaceTime, it was lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
He had dementia. He's gone now, but he had dementia. He was in his 90s. He was in a facility, couldn't get in. He was in Minneapolis. And it's hard, you know. I mean, this, probably a lot of listeners have gone through this with parents. Going through this with your parent is hard.
Mm.
And it's hard when you're far away. He can't really connect. He doesn't hear that well. He's out of it a lot of times. But that time when I was carding and it was so slow and so boring doing this ancient art, I could sit with him on this hyper-modern technology and just be there with him.
Hmm.
And sometimes he thought I was, you know, he'd go, Peg, can you hand me a glass of water? No, Dad, I can't. Yeah. But it was such...
What was he doing during that time?
He was watching baseball. The Twins, so he's in Minneapolis, the Twins were, they were playing Twins games, right? And the Twins always won. And he thought it was because of something he was doing with his walker. And I was like, what is it, Dad? And he said, trade secret. You know, and then we would sing because that part of the brain is different than the part that's affected by dementia. And he could remember songs. And so we would sing, and mostly like...
Like what, you know, kind of song?
You are my sunshine, oh. My only sunshine.
Oh,
you
man.
Make me happy when skies are gray. Oh. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
Oh, man.
That was a big one.
Just with your dad sitting there.
Yeah, with my dad. I miss him. And I will say that time together, being able to slow down, that was one of the real gifts of doing this book and going through this process, was that I have that time that we were together and just being able to love him like that. And it's a real gift now that he's gone.
Ah, it's beautiful. We're talking with writer Peggy Ornstein about her new memoir, Unraveling, What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. We would love to hear from you. We know there's some knitters out there in the audience, and we'd love to know, why do you knit? And have you ever thought about doing the full process like this, you know, from sheep to sweater? Have you ever done it? You can give us a call. Number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or KQED Forum, and the email's forum@kqed.org. Again, we would love to hear from you knitters. Maybe you even have knitting needles in your hands right now. We definitely want to hear from you. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We'll be back with more with Peggy Ornstein right after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're here in the studio with Peggy Ornstein talking about her new memoir. It's kind of a memoir, right?
It is a memoir.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. New memoir, Unraveling What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. We're kind of walking through the steps that are required to kind of go from a sheep to a sweater. And so far, we've made it through the shearing, which, you know, where you're actually taking the wool off the sheep and kind of cleaning it, carding it. And then we get to this incredible section that you have in this book, which is really about spinning and what spinning is. And I was hoping, you know, for those of us like myself who maybe don't know how spinning works, maybe you can describe. Like, I'm familiar with the kind of fairy tale version of it, and I can see a spinning wheel in my head, but I have no idea what's actually happening during that process.
Yeah. And I write a lot about the fairy tales. I love fairy tales anyway, but fairy tales were really invented or evolved from women spinning, because women, they didn't have the internet, they didn't have TV, and they spun all the time. So they had to do something. So they would tell each other these stories, which used to be quite bawdy. They've gotten less bawdy over time as they've become children, and more gruesome, weirdly, to teach children lessons. But anyway, spinning, you've got this, you've carded this, the fleece, and it's all nice and puffy. And then there's different ways of doing it, but you basically are kind of pinching and pulling it out. And I can't describe this. And then and the wheel, and you're pedaling with your feet, and it's kind of a hand-eye foot coordination thing.
But you're kind of feeding this fiber.
And you're feeding it fiber into this kind of hole, which is called the orifice, in the wheel on the maiden, which is atop the mother of all. I mean, there's a lot of these these kind of female metaphors, and the bobbin is swelling almost like a pregnant belly. And one of the things that was really cool to me about that I learned about spinning was how often spinning is in creation myths, and how often spinning, like the Greeks, it's not exactly a creation myth, but when you're born, three sisters visit you. They spin, one spins the fiber, one measures it out, one cuts it off, and that's your life. And I just loved the idea that it was spinning and women who were the creators of life, because what is really, you know, more magical and more divine than making something from nothing, whether you're making thread from fiber or, you know, bread from flour, or a human from nowhere at all.
Yeah. And you also found that, you know, it wasn't just in kind of European cultures. This was like all over the world.
All over the world.
This spinning is a shared cultural experience.
Yeah. Because everybody has to spin wherever spinning was. And spinning was everywhere. So the spider grandmother in the American Southwest was another one. There's a lot of spiders and a lot of grandmothers and a lot of spinning. Because, I mean, creating the world. Yeah, it's this act of I'm kind of rubbing my fingers because it's like this tactile thing. Mm-hmm. And it just made a lot of sense to me that it was women in a lot of cultures and that it involved textiles. Because we come into this world, right, Alexis? When we come into this world, we're wrapped in cloth. Mm-hmm. When we leave this world, we're wrapped in cloth. Mm-hmm. In between, we spend a lot of time wrapped in cloth.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point. Let's go to our first caller. Before we get too far away from shearing, we have Jessica in El Sobrante who wants to know a little bit more about shearing. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi. Thanks for having me. This is very fascinating. I am lucky enough to be a member milker of a local goat collective up here, and we are seven women who own and take care of and milk goats, and we also have two sheep. And right now we don't shear the sheep, and they're very skittish. They're not as approachable as the goats. And I loved hearing about your experience with the sheep, and I'm inspired and wondering, what advice would you give to start from the very beginning, where to look to figure out how to approach these sheep and starting this whole process? Because this is amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you have to kind of do a little research and learn. I had met somebody through the store in Oakland, A Verb for Keeping Warm, which I write about, which is this wonderful place where they, it's a dyeing studio, it's a spinning studio, it's a yarn studio. And through the owners of that store, I met somebody who could teach me how to shear sheep. There are some small flock shearers. There used to be a class in Mendocino, but I'm not sure, in the early May, but I might not have come back after the pandemic. So I would also check at the Extension School of Humboldt up in that way.
Yeah. Jessica, it's kind of amazing, isn't it, that it's actually probably pretty hard
to learn
how to do this.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's hard to learn how to do it well. It depends on what you're doing with it. But it also speaks to the fact that the wool industry has kind of disappeared mm-hmm. with the rise of synthetic fabrics and offshoring, both of which have been kind of devastating, and the synthetic fabrics have just been a disaster for the environment. But wool used to be so common and so important to the American economy that there was a Miss Wool of America pageant on TV every year that Art Linkletter used to host, and people like Frankie Avalon would come and perform on it. And the big thing was the modeling of the new wool fashions. And, you know, it was just a great history to learn. And I think that people get very interested in the fact that I went off and learned how to do this because we've become so urbanized and we don't do it anymore.
Yeah. Jessica, thanks so much for that call. And I love the idea of you on your goat collective with your friends, learning goats, learning sheep. I wanted to talk a little bit more about that sort of historical importance of some of these fiber arts. In particular, you know, in the book you deal with, you know, cotton, which of course is we somehow talk about cotton and the institution of slavery without actually normally connecting it into the history, like what's happening to that cotton, right? Why is it so important? Why are these areas in the South using enslaved people's labor? Why do they become so wildly rich? Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and even, you know, where that cotton ends up, which is in New England in the new factories of America.
Yeah. I mean, in the American South and also India, the colonialization of India by England, one of the things that I didn't know was that Gandhi used to spin every day for an hour at 4 a.m. or something, because it was really crucial to his idea of independence and self-determination for Indians. He encouraged everybody to spin, and he wanted to put a spinning wheel in the center of the Indian flag at independence because it was so important to him. So looking at sort of the impact of, I mean, cotton, I wasn't quite as honestly as deep on,
yeah.
But looking at the influence of that and the influence of the mills the Industrial Revolution and the importance of spinning to Industrial Revolution and the way that took women out of the home and put them into mills, and that their protest against the horrific treatment in the mills, particularly in the United States, they did these protests that became the foundation for both the American labor movement and the American feminist movement, and that it was no—I mean, I think that it was no accident that years later we have these young female voices. Greta Thunberg or X Gonzalez, who's now non-binary but who grew up in a female body, and Malala, because teenage girls have always been our political voice, our voice of conscience, our leaders. So that was an amazing thing. And then the other piece was not only cotton but color, which we haven't talked about, mm-hmm. and indigo was one of the places that I really looked at. You know, there was this sort of weird duality where on one hand, the person who figured out supposedly how to create indigo in the United States,
yeah,
during
like the person
period,
who's credited with
who's
it,
credited,
in the Carolinas, yeah,
was Eliza Pinckney, who allegedly developed it as a teenager at her father's plantation and created the big cash crop. There was rice, there was indigo, there was cotton. But in fact, her discovery, and she gets a lot of credit, and, you know, teenage girl doing something science-y, George Washington was a pallbearer at her funeral, but it depended entirely on enslaved labor. The West Africans who had grown indigo in West Africa and knew how to do that and knew how to process it and did all the work. And so, you know, you got that kind of little bit of white feminism thing, but there's that sort of duality of both, you know, the beauty and the blood that run through all of these textile arts.
Yeah. Let's, before we get deeper into dyeing, which is a great, great part of this book, one of the really beautiful passages, let's go to the phones for a little bit. Kimberly in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I just wanted to say that during the pandemic, I started working at a yarn store in San Francisco, and it kind of like saved my life and branched out into a whole new thing of like teaching knit and crochet classes to other people in the Bay Area.
And then I ended up volunteering teaching classes at my daughter's school. And it's just been the greatest, most rewarding thing.
What do you find rewarding about it?
You can definitely, you know, make your own clothing. You can make gifts for people. You can make things out of sustainable textiles. And a lot of the things are one of a kind and really unique.
Mm-hmm. Does something happen in your mind when you're doing these kind of fiber arts? Like what happens in there?
Sometimes it's like you're free forming it. And so you're just being extra creative. But sometimes I really enjoy following a pattern and just the challenge of figuring out the pattern and doing it successfully. And it's also nice to just do it and concentrate totally on knitting or crocheting and not be distracted by all of the other drama going on in the world.
Yeah. Right? I mean, that's the big thing for me. It's been so beautiful with this book. I've heard so many wonderful stories about the role of craft in women's lives. During the peak of lockdown, it was pretty much the only thing that calmed me down. And needlework is known to create a kind of serenity. It has the same as meditation. Mm-hmm. It has the same sort of qualities on blood pressure and on mood and all. It's a wonderful thing to do for just your well-being.
Yeah. And, you know,
yeah, even at the store, we had people where their therapist had recommended that they take up knitting and crocheting to give them peace of mind.
And what did you find the community of knitters like, Kimberly? Like, what was your experience of it?
So for me, I grew up in a basically all-white community. I'm adopted from South Korea, and I never had any Asian friends. And so one of the greatest things in the Bay Area was the diversity and meeting so many different knitters from like all different ways of life. But that being said, I would say a lot of fiber arts is mostly older, financially secure white women.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find that to be also true that it wasn't. And on one hand, I make a point in a Times piece I wrote this weekend when I'm writing about political knitting and how, in fact, knitting is fairly diverse, that I don't want to throw the women who are the traditional knitters under the bus, because there's nothing wrong with us and we've done some amazing things politically. But I do in the book, I didn't really make a deal out of it. I didn't say it. But because I am that stereotypical knitter, I wanted everybody that I learned from to not be. So either they are younger, or they are queer, or they are non-binary, or they are women. They're all women, because I really did want that. But I didn't want them. I wanted to sort of make a subtle point throughout the book that there is a diversity of people who engage in fiber arts, and there always have been.
Yeah. Kimberly, thank you so much for that call. Just really appreciate that experience. Let's talk a little bit about dying. Vicky
D-Y-E.
Vicky in San Jose, I think, came to some natural dying. We'll go in through Vicky. Hey, Vicky.
Yeah. So I have a group of friends that mostly play Celtic harp, believe it or not. And we all got into fiber arts. I had already been a knitter, but I found this book written back in the hippie days, and I'm in my 70s now. And I thought, oh, this is so cool. It was Dye Plants of California. So we would have these retreats in Pescadero at this old funky place. And we would go out and find these plants. And I mean, I every time we went hiking, I'd be sneaking a fungus or a mushroom or something. And you wouldn't believe what you can dye with. You can dye. There's a mushroom. Mm-hmm. I think it's, people call it dog. Turd mushroom, and it's got all kinds of
the
things,
classic dog turd mushroom.
It's the big puff, the big reddish brown puff that makes fantastic browns. And then the oxalis that is in everybody's yard, the weed, is like clover with the bright yellow. That makes a fantastic burnt sienna orange if you add ammonia.
Oh,
so I learned all about dyeing and fixing and more denting. So what happened was, we would have these retreats, play harp for a while, then go out and we'd dye in the kitchen, and then we'd have all of this fiber, which could be silk, it could be alpaca, it could be, and it was some really wonderful fibers. We put it all out on the deck and take pictures, and I have pictures of this rainbow pile. But what happened, of course, was we all went our separate ways eventually. One person got into weaving to the extent that she had an electronic loom, which kind of defeats the purpose. And then the rest of us end up with what we call a stash. And I'm sure you're familiar with that, where you end up with so much yarn, so many fleeces, so much roving. You've got two spinning wheels. You've got a spindle. You've got knitting. And you realize, I'm not going to live forever. So then you have to deal with getting rid of it, deciding, what am I going to do with all this? And I sold some on Etsy, but it's like, to me, it's kind of like an arc through your life.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, music is number one now. I've gone back to cello, which is my first instrument.
So, Vicky, yeah, I love it. Yeah.
It's still there. Yeah. But, you know, so I think this creativity is really key to it.
That is such a good point. You know, the creativity piece, and I'll get back to Diane in a second, but partway through the book, I talk about this Linda Barry cartoon that I used to have in my office, where she is drawing sort of, you know, she talks about herself as a kid drawing in this like freeform way. And then she says, at some point you ask these, you learn the two questions, is this good or does this suck? Mm. And those are the questions of death to creativity. And so to try to start asking yourself when you're doing this, and this is what I learned while this was, you know, one of the great takeaways for this for me was learning to ask different kinds of questions, which were about like, how did that work? What might I do differently this time? What would be fun next time? And to try to keep your eye on, to have something in your life where you try to keep your eye on process over product.
Yeah. Vicky, thank you so much. Please invite me to your next gathering. I'll make the tea. I got it. We are talking with writer Peggy Ornstein about her new memoir, Unraveling What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. I am really enjoying your phone calls, Peggy. I hope you're enjoying these phone calls as well.
It's such great. They're such great stories.
They're great stories.
And
they're
the color
so fun.
Thing was so cool, Alexis. I mean, I got really into, as you mentioned, got really into color.
Yes.
It was very fun.
We are going to talk about that right after the break, because it really is very exciting. We'd love to hear from you. Why do you knit? I know we've got some listeners, some men, who are saying, hey, men can knit are into it. So if you're a guy who knits, give us a call. You're a non-binary person who knits, give us a call. Number is 866-733-6786. We're hearing about these natural dyes. Do you like dyeing with natural things? And what have you used? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, we're KQED Forum. The email is forum@kqed.org. A couple of comments. Sue writes, my mom taught me to knit at age 6 because I was bored and bugging her. That was 67 years ago. We have way too many sweaters at our house, so now I knit for charity. I do prosthetic breasts for women who've had mastectomies and send them to knittedknockers.org. Huh. I knit caps for chemo patients who have lost their hair and give them to Knitters by the Bay or directly to Stanford Hospital. Thanks for sharing that, Sue. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We'll be back with more from Peggy Ornstein right after the break.
I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon. Now I'm no longer alone.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're here with best-selling writer Peggy Ornstein talking about her new memoir, Unraveling, What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. We were, for the break, talking a little bit about this dyeing process and natural dyes, and it is extremely fascinating how, let's just talk about how you would dye something blue.
Oh, well, blue is like its own thing. It's different than everything else, and that was why it became its own chapter.
And why is it different?
Because it doesn't, it sits, you have to do this whole chemical thing, which I can't really explain, because if I do, I get this very powerful urge to check my text messages. I just think of it as magic. But you have to sort of create a vat, and you have to dip, it's really complicated, and you have to dip the fabric in, and it kind of builds up as opposed to soaking in, which is why your jeans, if you get really dark jeans,
they rub off
on you.
Yeah.
Because it's, and why they fade. And it's one of the things actually that I thought about environmentally is that, you know, people throw their clothes away all the time when they fade or when they rip or, you know, these sorts of things, but not our jeans. And if we could think about our other clothes more the way that we think about our genes, in this way that individualizes them and makes them sort of part of us, I think we would have a different relationship with our clothes and with the environmental impact of our clothes.
What did you like about dyeing, like the actual, you know, process of it?
One was just thinking about, since I was using natural dyes and look and trying to, as much as possible for a while anyway, get them from my yard or from my neighborhood, it just made everything kind of psychedelic. Like I just started, everything was just like pulsating at me. You know, I'd look at the leaves on my pear tree and think, what color would they make? Or, you know, the fig tree. And you could sort of make things that grounded you in your sense of place and home. And then color itself, like the idea that one of the things that emerged for me in my one of my rabbit holes of research was color is a cultural construct. You know, like the ancient Greeks,
the wine dark sea,
the bronze sky, they didn't, blue irrelevant to them, didn't see it, didn't have it, wasn't a color. And you just think, how could they not see blue? But then I think, well, other cultures see, don't care about the prism. They see things as damp or dry, shiny or rough. I don't know what that means. Or I do, but I don't care when I look at something. It's red. I don't care that the light above my microphone is shiny. It's red.
So interesting. Stephen wants to say, one of our listeners, you've made several references to women and knitting. I took up knitting several years ago and learned that knitting was started by fishermen to make their nets, and that during the Middle Ages, only men were allowed to knit. Was that, any of that information come up for you in the research?
Yeah, but it's not quite true that knitting was developed by fishermen, but they did do, but string, I mean, that's one of the things about string that's amazing, that Elizabeth Whalen Barber, who writes about ancient work, talks about the string revolution, that when we figured out as humans how to twirl stuff and make string, it was as important as fire, because it let us bind things, it let us make nets, it let us do all these carry, you know, things that we couldn't do before, trap. But yeah, men knit, and I talk in the book a little bit about the political knitting men did. There's a group of men in Chile that knit in public as an act of gender nonconformity, and they wear sort of classic men's suits, and then they knit with pink yarn as a way to critique gender, and I loved that. But yeah, men, of course, have always also knit, but I was kind of interested in women.
Yeah. Barbara writes in to say, just think about how you can take a couple of sticks or the little bend on the crochet hook and make any two- or three-dimensional object, like a scarf, a tote bag, even a shelter to sleep under, or just take a break from the rain or sun. That's amazing.
It's crazy. I know. That was sort of what got me going, Barbara. You're absolutely right. You're like, who thought of this and how? And, you know, and by the way, there's somebody who does knitting as, thinks about knitting as code, and knits and purls as the ones and zeros of code. And they have used that to make all, to think about all kinds of three-dimensional objects and changing ways that we think about, like, prosthetic limbs and all. You know, there's some really interesting work that's being done that by people who, women particularly, who knit and have then gone into coding and figured out how to use that to change all kinds of stuff.
Let's bring in Thea in Oakland. Welcome.
Thank you. I am so excited to hear this program. I have been knitting since I was 8, and now I'm 53. And about 20 years ago, I started teaching knitting. Actually, I, you know, during the big dot-com bust and sort of, and also 9/11, you know, everyone is kind of reevaluating everything. And there was that draw towards knitting for the comfort. And I always say to my students that it's a lot cheaper than both therapy plus a really well-made sweater. If you can knit and you can make it yourself, it's cheaper than those two things together. It's a joke, but there's definitely the therapeutic element. But anyway, I'm excited to hear you speak at Bookshop West Portal tomorrow night,
oh,
which is where I've been.
Thank you. Thanks for plugging that.
Yeah.
I am speaking at Bookshop West Portal tomorrow night. Who taught you to knit when you were eight?
Well, I tried to learn from my mom, and somehow the communication didn't quite work well. So I wound up learning from my third grade friend's grandmother.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, years later, I wound up doing a retreat, sort of couture knitting techniques with my mom. And then she was having difficulty sort of understanding it from the teacher, but then I would turn around and teach her, and that's how I started teaching. But I just wanted to say that knitting is just such a great portal for so many things. You know, like it was a lifeline to me during the pandemic to have a social, the knitting social that I actually have tonight at the bookshop went virtual, you know, and it was for me a lifeline. And for a lot of people, as we had, you know, loved ones get sick, you know, I mean, not necessarily some from COVID or, you know, some from everything else, you know, and so I just...
That's great.
Yeah, it's rich.
There is a whole theme in the book about learning from our moms. I started abbreviating it after a while, S-L-H-F-M. She learned from her mom. I learned from my mom. And when I was knitting during lockdown, I would talk to my mom all day, every day, although she was dead. And I was trying to sort of reckon with my relationship with her, which could be fraught, but knitting was something that always brought us together. And I think it worked that way for a lot of mothers and daughters. And then I say later that I didn't teach my daughter to knit because I actually knit in a weird way. And I wanted her to learn in a more, a better, faster way and use that as kind of a metaphor to talk about what we do learn from our moms, what we don't learn from, and what we learn from our moms that we want to pass on and what we learn from our moms that we don't want to pass on to our daughters.
Nancy writes in to say, I love this conversation. I followed a voice that said, learn to sew, while at the same time taking a class in memoir writing. Both of my grandmothers sewed, and one professionally as a dressmaker. I feel so connected to them, even though I only knew one of them. I know them better through this craft. The attention to detail and precision and creativity informs me as to who they needed to be in order to do this well.
Oh, that's so, I mean, I can't even express how many beautiful stories I've been hearing since publishing Unraveling. And just, I mean, from men and women and other people as well, and just these memories, these beautiful memories of mothers and of grandmothers and also the political knitting, the knitting that people have done for charity, or that somebody just sent me something that at the New York legislature, they just unfurled a banner that was enormous, that had Lady Liberty, but her torch is a uterus, and it was for reproductive rights. I mean, the activism around fiber arts, too, has just been... It's just inspiring. It just lifts my heart.
Another beautiful family story before we go to Sandeep in Los Altos. Margot writes, my aunt taught me to knit 25 years ago. She was dying of cancer, and that connection remains for me to this day. That familial connection of passing on something creative is so meaningful to me. Also, the sweaters that I have been knitting and gifting to my adult daughters, the act of knitting itself is very meaningful. You need to start again and be comfortable with pulling out rows and rows of stitches. There's a patience that's required. Sandeep in Los Altos, welcome.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to share a story about my mother. She's 93 now, and when she retired about 10, 15 years ago, she's been a knitter all her life, but mostly for making sweaters and things. But I think the whole family got tired of her sweaters because she had made some. And in the last few years, she's also had dementia and loss of hearing, and lost my father, who was her husband, about 3 years ago. So put all of that together, and she's lonely, and she can't really watch TV because she can't hear too well. She can't read because she says, I can't follow the story. Mm. And knitting has become her savior. Mm. She knits nonstop, like literally 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And what she is, since she's not making sweaters for anyone, we found her some nonprofits where she knits caps for cancer patients because they need soft woolen caps after mm-hmm. chemo. And she also knits for, I think it's called Knit America or something, mm-hmm. where she makes these 7 or 8 inch by 8 inch pieces and sends it to them, and they weave it into or stitch it into a blanket for the homeless and other benefits. Yeah. And it's been just so therapeutic for her, because that is literally the only thing that she enjoys doing. And the greatest stress it creates for me is to make sure that she has enough yarn. Yeah. Because she knits so fast, she's knitting 6-7 hours a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if she is out of yarn, she gets seriously stressed. And I told her, why don't you take a break for a day? And she said, no. If I take a break for a day, my mind starts wandering into, you know, she starts getting depressed.
So
therapeutic. And she feels such a sense of accomplishment because she's doing something for nonprofits. I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, Sandeep, that's a great.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
thank
that's
you,
a great
Sandeep.
Story. Kind of connection to, you know, her body and her life and what it is to...
And brings in a whole lot of... I mean, for one thing, yes, it is true that knitting staves off dementia. That is one of the things that they've found about it. But also that whole piece of what we do with our craft. And I'm a terrible Instagrammer, but I've just been lately trying to put up things that people make that they've been... Projects they've been doing for politically or for charity to show kind of the breadth and the meaning of all that we do with knitting.
Yeah. Let's go to Jennifer in Petaluma. Welcome, Jennifer.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am at the Petaluma Adobe State Historic Park, and we usually hold a sheep shearing, and the pandemic shut that down. And this year, we're actually trying to get sheep and do our event again. And it brings together a very interesting group of people that just want to see the sheep sheared, but we also get weavers and spinners and knitters, we hope. It's been really fun when we've gotten a really nice mix of people.
You need to get together with the earlier caller.
Yeah, that's right.
For the shearer.
Yeah,
I hope that's she's still listening. Maybe you can get together.
Yeah, so hopefully, I'm hoping to make that connection.
Yeah.
I'm at the Petaluma Adobe, call me. Part of what I've seen with the event is that the people that first just get into seeing the process of where it all starts are the kids. Really young kids, it's the parents that bring their kids in strollers, and they're just like, this is where your clothing starts.
Yeah.
And
that connection. And we were fortunate to have a volunteer that came in and taught us some historic dyeing techniques that we actually got to do here in the park. And like, this is a cochineal.
So cochineal that was one of the things that I write about, the rise of red and how red was really one of the bases of the Spanish Empire when they went off, you know, marauding and colonizing places. They found that these bugs in Central America, the females, I don't know how they could tell they were females, but they squished them and you'd get this one drop of durable carmine pure red. And it took hundreds of thousands of them to make a pound of cloth, which, you know, so they were worth their weight in gold, more than their weight in gold. And they kept secret for hundreds of years that this was bugs. Nobody knew what it was. And they brought them back and they made, you know, it was a fortune. It's how they funded what they did. It was incredible. And then, it like rises and falls. Red comes up, then blue comes up, and the merchants of red are trying to stop the merchants of blue. So they bribe the stained glass makers to try to make them make hellfire blue so people associate that with hell and won't wear blue and it doesn't work. And like there's these crazy stories and then the whole thing collapses in a minute with the invention of chemical dye by this college student who's like the Steve Jobs of his generation and just kind of goes, oops, and finds this pink stuff in a test tube that doesn't come out of the cloth. And within a couple of decades, natural dye collapses. and we lose it, and it's gone. Most of it is gone.
And that's just because it's easier to make from fossil fuels.
It's easier to make, and it has tremendous, tremendous environmental impact, the color of our clothes.
That's so interesting. Let's take one last call. I'm sorry, the phone lines, the knitters lighting up the phone lines, Peggy.
I love that.
I love it, too. Linda in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to say, I was listening earlier about when you were talking about learning knitting from your mother. And, you know, I just wanted to add my story, which is that my mother is not a knitter, and I've always loved textile arts and things like that. And the way that I learned to knit was learning from friends and going online, because there's so many great resources online.
Are you a Ravelry person?
Wonderful. I am a Ravelry
person. Everybody's a Ravelry person, Alexis. You can't not be a Ravelry person.
Yeah, it's just amazing how much you can learn. There's great, you know, YouTube tutorials. So, you know, because I was trying to learn from books, but it was just impossible for me. And then until somebody sat down, like my boyfriend's sister showed me how to do the knit stitch. Mm-hmm. And then everything else I've learned from, like, looking online.
Yeah, I kind of joke that there's infinite YouTube.
Yeah, thank you, Linda.
It's great, yeah. And you know, the learning from friends is important. Well, I talk about, I'm probably the last, I was the last class to take home ec, to have girls home ec before Title IX kicked in. And the girl was sitting next to me, and we had to knit scarves, and hers kept coming out like a rhombus. It just was not going to work. She was going to flunk home ec. And so I was like, here, give it to me. And I knit her scarf for her, and that is my best friend. And we have been best friends for 40 years.
Oh, I love that. I have to 50. Read you these last two comments, which are both so amazing. Victoria writes, I'm an agricultural worker in Marin County, and I spin and knit. My mother-in-law taught me the art form and gave me a spinning wheel, which she refurbished herself. She was a child in post-World War II Germany. She and her friends would gather the wool that caught in fences to bring home and spin into yarn for garments. As a financially strapped millennial, I'm grateful for this survival skill that has been passed down to me. And then check this one out. Jane writes, as a lifelong knitter and spinner of 30 years, I've noticed a positive effect on my well-being. To explore this further, I pasted electrodes onto my scalp and read the spectrogram while knitting and later spinning. These activities increase the alpha waves of my brain activity. It's the beginning phase of meditation and a very relaxed but attentive state. The bilateral aspect of knitting has an effect of being able to process issues with both sides of the brain. Knit on. Don't you want to meet Jane?
Why didn't I think of doing that? Wool gathering. Wool gather, right? You're gathering wool.
Yeah.
That off of the fences and stuff, that was initially how people...
Yeah.
God.
My
Whoa.
God. Jane, can you send me an email? I want to hear more about this.
It's
amadrigal@kqed.org. We can put you in touch with Peggy. I think that is just such a great story. We have been joined in the studio here by Peggy Orenstein talking about her new memoir, Unraveling What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. Thank you so much for coming in,
Peggy. This was the most fun. Thank you. I love hearing these stories.
She'll be at Bookshop West Portal tomorrow and at Book Passage Corte Madera on Saturday. This is Joni Mitchell. This is also Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.